Some people do, so.
No.
Commission 18. Yeah.
I think that's ridiculous when you've got kids basically saying, no, I'll take the left one.
I know.
Yeah, well, I got really well for nursing, your kids are all really
I know.
It's just absurd.
Yeah, but not my forte.
I think that has more to do with the parents than it has with kids.
Well, the belief that breast milk is good for as long as you can have it. Here it is.
I know the theories. I know how we made it back in the day. How we made it.
I'm shooting for the year mark. I'll be happy.
Yeah.
The May 16th meeting of the commission. Oh, okay. One moment.
Are you on?
Yes. The May 16th meeting of the Commission on Aging will please come to order. If there are no changes to the agenda, may I have a motion for it to be approved?
So moved.
Second?
Yes.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? You reviewed the minutes from April 18th. Are there any changes to those minutes? Any revisions? If not, is there a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second?
Second. Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Reports, the Public Health Advisory Committee update.
Yeah, we went to the Public Health Advisory Committee, actually Marjorie went, and did a presentation about last year's housing series, and, sorry, I just turned on. We went and had our, gave an update about our housing series and the recommendations that we had come up with, and we're going to, they're going to endorse our recommendations, so we're moving forward with our partnership with the Public Health Advisory Committee.
Thank you. Pat, do you have a report from the area agency and disabilities?
Yes, I do. I was unable to attend, so Linda O'Leary attended for me, but this is her report. There was a presentation at the meeting from the Meals on Wheels people, the Clark County Senior Nutrition Contractor. Both Suzanne Washington and Renata Wilson were there. They will be ceasing serving meals at the Furstenberg Center due to the expense of serving such a small number of people. There's an average of only 14 people that come to that center for meals. They are researching, the Meals on Wheels people are researching providing a cafe restaurant type meal that could be for all ages. And they're investigating the details of this, facilities and location, and it will pilot at one site to measure its success. This will not affect Meals on Wheels. Any people that were being served Meals on Wheels from the Furstenberg Center will still receive their meals. And of course, people who went to the Furstenberg Center can come to the Luebke Center if they wish. Christina Munoz of the Agency on Aging presented two pilot projects that will start in July of this year. The projects are the Medicaid Transformation Project Initiative 2, addressing the demands of the age wave. And the other project is Medicaid Transformation Foundational Community Supports. And I'm not going to give you a full report on those two programs. But if anybody would like more information, I'd be happy to provide it. Thank you.
Anybody have any questions for that? Tonight is our third in a series for our focus this year on supportive services. The purpose of the supportive services focus is to raise awareness about supportive services that exist or may need to exist in Clark County's aging population. The goal is to connect the services with people so they can stay in their homes for as long as they wish to do so. At the end of the year, we will be taking any recommendations we develop, not only from the experts we have coming to speak with us, but also from the questions and comments you and the public provide to us. In all our endeavors, the public is essential to what we do. So when you ask a question, it does become part of the record, and many times we follow up on that. Tonight's presentation is about home innovation and safety, and our speaker is Susan Doyle. Dr. Doyle, who has a private practice in Battleground, has been an occupational therapist for more than 35 years, as well as a certified aging in place specialist. She will discuss the role of occupational therapy in maintaining independence, injury prevention, and the technological tools that enable seniors to function as well as they can in their own home. Welcome, Susan.
Thank you, and thanks for this opportunity. I'm really pleased to see the community involvement in talking to helping people age in place. And also, just to make our community the great one that we have and continue that, I want to talk tonight about occupational therapy in terms of home safety, because I think, where do we point technology is great. A, when you know how to operate it, and then when it works. One of the things I want to talk a little bit about is what occupational therapy can offer and some of the potential roles and highlights that are coming out. They're innovative, looking at keeping people home safely, but not just home safely, looking at quality of life, looking at some of the tools we have available. More importantly, looking at the research that supports this direction, and then looking at how we run it, what kind of access, and some of the innovative ways we're looking at to try and increase access. When we look overall at what occupational therapists do, we're talking about therapists that have a master's minimum degree now, so I'm not coming out with a clinical doctorate. They've spent a couple of years looking at, we'll talk about some of the unique education, but it brings them with a role of skill, a range of skills that include things like environmental modifications and home safety. We're going to talk about direct implications for fall prevention, assistive technology, prescription and training, health and wellness, dealing with depression, dealing with quality of life, dealing with change in roles, habits, routines, management of chronic illnesses, and then caregiver support and training as well, which is really important. One thing that I saw that hasn't been looked at, community mobility and older driver, and being able to look at safety in that area, and we'll talk a little bit about that, because that also impacts on your safety at home or where your home is. Role transitions, which is really important, and transition is related to moving and maintaining participation. What happens when you have to move? What does that look like? How do you still maintain quality of life? Those are all concerns for occupational therapy in this area of productive aging. The unique skills that occupational therapy brings comes from the integration of the understanding of the person. Our medical background, understanding diagnoses, looking at physical abilities, understanding the progression of illness, the impact of normal aging, looking at understanding person's values and interests and how to combine those with the activities that they want to choose or want to be involved in, looking at cognition, vision, and safety judgment. The other piece that's a really unique skill is that ability to assess the environment, to look not only at accessibility, which is what we think of clearly, but looking at the impact on the task, not only the heights, not only the amount of objects available, but things like color contrast, things like the cognitive demands of the environment and the supports for being involved and engaged. And then looking at the demands of the task itself. From an occupational therapy perspective, occupation is everything that you do in your life, not just a job. So today when I was treating my 93-year-old client, he was an occupational therapist. I'm done with work a long time ago. I'm like, but the work of living is why we're here. That job of being involved and engaged. And this is the unique perspective that OT has because we can bring that. This really gives you an advantage beyond just the certified aging in place, the architect who's been able to design the ADA, because now you're designing it uniquely for this person. For some of us, if we had a raised toilet seat or the comfort high toilet seat, we would be swinging our feet off the ground and not be safe. For some of us, even the standard, the comfort high toilet seat may not be tall enough. So thinking about that unique match, thinking about how we actually perform the task, what is it about the task and how we do it? If I was to ask each one of you here, how you had a shower, how you got dressed in the morning, we would have unique characteristics related to that that would impact the environmental needs, the accessibility needs, even some of the timing related to that. So this is one of the things that OT brings specifically. It's that match between that unique person, their environment, and what it is they want to do in that environment. Then what we can do is identify the training, compensation, or adaptation that needs to include to occur. In one of the things that sometimes happens, it's really nice to change the environment, but if you're looking at a person who doesn't have necessarily all the skills to adapt to that change, or that change itself is stressful, how do you help the person make that adjustment if it's necessary? So again, having the skills and the ability to do that. The other thing to understand is altering the environment to look at a particular way of doing a shower or transfer may work for this next 6 months or maybe the next year. But if you have a change in your health status that is progressive or is going to continue to change, then understanding the needs of how that's going to progress and what that looks like, and that burden it may place on the caregiver if you didn't think about that when you made the initial adaptations. Ability to work with clients who have cognitive impairments, understanding their impairments, limits, challenges, but still having them be involved, having them feel like they've got a role to play, and having them work with you to identify what's important to them is really a key skill that I see from occupational therapy. And then if we're making home modifications, being that liaison between the contractor and the client to make sure that the needs are being met and that you're translating the language from the client's needs to what the contractor needs. And so that's one of the unique skills and advantages of having an OT in that mix. We look a lot at physical changes and needing adaptations for that. And I know last year you talked a lot about housing needs and some of the changes for physical abilities with that. I want to put up a couple of things just related to impairments that we don't normally consider. One is low vision, and looking at things not only just the simple hazard removals, but looking at lighting changes that are task and person specific. I was working with a client recently, and someone had increased the lighting in their stairway. But what it meant was as they were coming down their stairway, that lighting glare hit them in the eyes, and that increased the fall risk. So being aware of all of those client characteristics, their habits, is really important. Some of the new things that are coming out related to that now are things like being able to look at automation for lighting. And that's really important if you see people who not only have vision changes, but have cognitive changes. So being unable to remember to turn on switches, or that adds to the task complexity, being able to do that's really key. Things like knowing where contrast help or contrast hinder. Sometimes delineating a space, marking boundaries are really helpful. One of the things that I see that happens a lot when we do adaptations in the shower, everything looks the same color. And if you're having vision changes, you don't usually wear your glasses in the shower either. And so it's very difficult then to understand where the grab bar is, where the soap bar is, some of those safety things. So being aware and making those changes. Also, the appropriate magnification. Where do you need magnification? When you're cooking, when you find things in the refrigerator, what kinds of tasks or habits or hobbies are you involved in? What does that look like? Because that will vary. When I talk about medication management, we're not talking about prescribing the drugs, but looking at how do you go about finding your medication for the day? what does that look like? How do you know if you've remembered you've taken it? What if you can't see, how do you identify those labels on that medication? And sometimes being able to get a pharmacy to print larger labels, but some of the commercial pharmacies, that's just not an option. And so being able to come up with strategies to manage that. The other things are adaptations that look at improving task effectiveness. So things like, how is your closet organized? What clothes do you wear? How do we identify what things work together, what things don't work together? How do we identify where you put things back? What are settings and routines and habits that support that? So it's really important to start to look at what are their normal roles and routines, how do you support those, and then what kinds of adaptations can you make? For example, do I need to, instead of on each of the tops of the coat hangers, do I need to put a series of rubber bands or a different color shades or a different band that identifies these are blue and they will match together? These are pink. What would that look like? Does that help? For some gentlemen, it may be sorting things in blocks together. It may be how they work. So again, taking the individual with that. Persons with dementia are another growing population that's often not seen as safety in home environmental modifications as important, but that's growing. More awareness of that now. So things like caregiver support and training, client and caregiver center evaluations are really key. What are the goals? What are the important tasks? One of the gentlemen that I was working with today, he was like, one of the things that's really important to me is I just want to be able to go and sit in my shop. What is it going to do in that shop? Well, I want to just be able to look at the things I made, and I'd like to just tinker a little bit. What does that look like? What's a safe way of tinkering? How can we allow that success, or at least that reminiscence about who I was as a person, to continue? How does your identity continue or be sustained in that situation? And then the environmental modifications. Maybe that means that in the shop I need to clear away all but the value tasks so that I can see those. Maybe I need to look at removing things that are a little unsafe or putting protective or guarded things there. So thinking about how the person is able to function, what that looks like and what their values are really key. There are also some really interesting electronic supports coming out now to look at still being able to do participation, but make people aware when there's safety breaches. For example, there are alarms if you go into a certain area of the house where medication may be or not be able to be safely contained. There are alarms if you go outside a certain area in the yard, so you can still walk in the garden or the yard, but then trigger that if you need that safe area. One of the things that's really important, there's a lot of research looking at being able to participate in those activities and some sensory stimulation has really decreased wandering, has really decreased some of the behavioral aspects that we see, and decreased some of the needs for the psychotropic medications for people with dementia in this area. So it's really important to be able to support the client and the caregiver to continue some of that. The other thing is, can you modify the tasks so that there's actually less steps, or that they're put out so that being able to initiate the task is easier? You don't have to get it out of a lockbox or out of a cabinet. So sometimes that really helps. And then some backward chaining, where you set it up and then have the complete the first step and then have the person just finish the task. So being able to understand the client's needs, looking at the level that they're at, and so there are assessments that we can do, and then structuring the task that way really help with the behavior changes and keeping people involved and active in their home situation. And one of the key things then, though, is to train the caregiver to work with that and support them, because you're looking at what do they need to be able to sustain that behavior to survive. When you look at assistive technology, there's a lot of changes that are coming out now. As I looked at this, it changes every day, just like how many of you got a new phone last week, and now it's already outdated. But the areas that we see that technology is helping us with are those alerts and stuff for people who are hard of hearing or have low vision. So that just some of the safety, fire, carbon dioxide, some of those things are really important. Alarms to signal for help. So being able to look at ways to modify calling for help. And that's something that we forget about often in the home environment, and people feel very insecure or left isolated if they don't have a way to do that. So how can we support that? And then compensation or assistance for people with physical or cognitive challenges. So electronic homes now are becoming so much widely accepted in the regular world, not in the assistive technology world, but it's really reduced the cost. I don't know if any one of you have Alexa or the Amazon Echo Dot. Be aware of what you say in front of it, though, as we've seen multiple questions. But being able to ask questions, being able to have it change the radio station, being able to have it change the TV station, are all easily available now for very limited financial cost, and also Silver Tea can work to identify what those priorities are, what task is it that person wants to be able to do, what's the best way to do that. When we look at medication management, we're not only talking about the types of medication, and I know you have a pharmacist coming next time, but now we're looking at how do you remember to take it daily, what does that look like, how does that fit into your routine, and what environmental modifications does that need. And it's very easy to go to bubble packs, but sometimes you can't get them out of the bubble packs. How do you remember if you took today's supply or this morning's supply? So there are some really nice electronic medication dispensers now that will allow you to do that. The key again with any of those, how many of you have struggled trying to operate your new phone? Right? That's not, I hear the noise. That takes a... So understanding, again, what the learning skills and what the cognitive abilities are of the person that we need to train, and which of these devices match best with their skills and needs, and which are going to achieve the goals that they want. The voice and remote activation are really nice. So I did set two ladies up in an assisted living facility once with remote control for the lamps. And they just happened to be in rooms beside each other. And I came back the next day and the lady was, my light just goes off, it's really weird. And I realized I forgot to put them on separate channels. But it does provide people with the safe ability to do tasks and have a sense of control in their environment and still be able to manipulate that environment. Cooking at home is a safety task, and being able to look at managing cooking safely is a skill, of course, we spend, and we'll talk about the assessments we have for that. But there are now stoves that have sensors on them that actually tell if you've moved away from the stove for more than 10 or 15 minutes, you can set it. It will automatically shut off anything that's operating unless you've pre-planned that. And so that's a really helpful technology. Because I often have clients who say, we stopped mom from cooking because she often burned things. Yeah, cooking was a really important, valuable occupation. And not only just was cooking, but cooking so that she could do something for her family members meant something really important. So this way we're able to adapt that. Some of the new technologies are the e-cottages. And I don't know if you've had anything on that with the building last time. But there's some really cool modules that are coming out now, and some of these are actually self-contained homes that can be placed in the back of a family member's home. And they are totally electronically, well, as much as you want them to be, controlled. So the lights come on and off at certain times, they have play slow, quiet music to wake someone up at that certain time, they monitor whether they're taking their medication. They also monitor if they've gone to the bathroom, how many times they've gone to the refrigerator. You can actually have the shopping list pulled from the refrigerator so the caregiver can shop before, you know, a family member can shop before they come to visit. because they know what's missing. They also can actually be as sophisticated as monitoring blood pressure, blood sugar, doing urine analysis. You can go all the way to very sophisticated, and then send messages to home care agencies, support agencies, and nurses about the state of health of that person. So there's some amazing things coming out. The key piece on that, though, is we're looking at protecting well-being, and we're keeping someone at home. But the importance of someone at home being healthily occupied is key to ongoing health and quality of life. And that's where the occupational therapist is key. Maintaining that maintains quality of life. And that's really important to be involved in. When we look at tools, occupational therapists have a range of tools that are now standardized, validated, that we've been doing a lot of research on, that allow us to make that match between the client and their environment. Some of them focus more on certain occupations, such as how do we function in the kitchen, how do we do in the bathroom. Some of them focus on high fall areas, and some of them focus on the client's own perception of safety at home and their fear of falling. One of the things that I find is that fear of falling itself actually prevents a lot of participation in a lot of exploration, and then it becomes a self-perpetuating cycle. And so being able to break that barrier, have people involved in those valued occupations, really requires some deep probing to understand what's going on underneath and then to match that with them. When we look at some of that, you can see that in the balance test and some of those ideas. Of course, these assessments identify accessibility issues, home barriers, the standard safety things that we look at, fire alarms, smoke detectors, also throw rugs, any of the fall and slip hazards that we need. One of the things that's happening now as well is that it's not often, not always, that you have an occupational therapist who's able to go out in the community or who is sufficiently trained to understand these areas. So we're seeing some research starting to look at how can we more efficiently exercise that skill for OTs available in the wider range of the community. And there are two things that I see a major research happening on right now. One of them is having a trained caregiver or nursing assistant go out and take a systematic review of videotaping or photography review of the environment, and also review an interview with a particular client, and then having the occupational therapist go over that. That one is relatively effective, but not as effective as if the occupational therapist was there. The other thing that's happening now is, of course, telehealth. And we're looking at telehealth being made available for a range of health professions, but in this situation, not for occupational therapists. In fact, our state law at this stage doesn't allow a lot of options for us, and Medicare and Medicaid have not included OT on that. So our licensure board for OTs is working on a statement related to telehealth at the moment, but Medicare and Medicaid don't recognize occupational therapy as being a profession for which that's suitable. The VA, of course, doesn't have that limitations, and they've actually been experimenting with having a caregiver in the home using telehealth terminals to actually have the occupational therapist remotely assess those occupations, the home safety. And they've had really great success with that, and great success with them following up with a remodeler or a handyman coming in at the same time. This has been done in rural remote North Carolina, has been really tried that. One of the things, again, I want to mention is just the older driver safety, because home is where a lot of occupations occur, but coming back and forth to home is key. Being able to access grocery stores, being able to access medical assistance, being able to go out for some of those occupations that are really valued, to meet friends, to be looking at the social activity. And so one of the things to be aware of, that occupational therapists can actually help fit the driver to their car, and looking at educating them around safety features, And I think just as important as by saying fit the person to the environment to the person within the house, we need to think about that in terms of the car as well. We can also assess and evaluate driving skills. And so that's key to remember. Should this person be driving? If they should, what does it look like? Should there be restrictions? One of the things that makes me really sad around here is when I hear lots of reports about drivers who have dementia, who are still driving, and they're safely able to drive back and forth to the grocery store until the day there's roadworks in the way. And then being able to problem solve how to get home safely after that, and we find them somewhere else lost. Being able to look at how to resume driving safely after an injury or an illness. Again, another skill for OT. And it's not just the driving in the car, but how do you get from your car into your house? Or vice versa. What does that look like, particularly in our green climate? And what are the alternatives to driving? I would say to do that, can we call transportation? How does our climate do that? What does it look like? So again, thinking of what those routines and habits were that supported driving or community mobility, and what they look like now in change, and how that affects safety at home. What does it mean for planning ahead? What does it mean for medication? How are occupational therapists funded? We're starting to see a change. The Area Agency on Aging is starting to look at some Medicaid waivers, looking at how occupational therapists coming in to work with clients who potentially, if they went into an institution, may end up in dependent on Medicaid, and so that we may be able to do some things collectively and preventively, which is really great. There are some of the demonstration Medicare Medicaid programs that we will talk about coming up that are showing cost effectiveness and looking at keeping people from moving out of their homes and also increasing their quality of life. Commercial insurance will cover for occupational therapy evaluation. Sometimes a little bit private payment. Overall, sometimes though there's a lack of resources, so thinking of being the awareness of what it takes to monitor that service. What does the research say? There's a lot of research to support this, and I think this is really key because it gives us an idea of some of the progress we can be doing in this community. The Well Elderly study was done out of University of Southern California by Dr. Florence Clark. The first one was done in 1999, and there she demonstrated that occupational therapists leading an education group that talked not only about home safety hazards, but also did individual advice on home safety hazards that looked at education and training related to how to maneuver aging, looking at safety in the kitchen, safety in the bathroom over a period of time, actually not only significantly improved quality of life, but it was cost effective. It reduced the number of medical incidents, reduced the number of costs needed, and social support services needed for those people. And those were considered well elderly. So that study there had 480. The Capable study was a Medicare, Medicaid demonstration done over on the East Coast. And we had 281 older adults in that. And they had an OT, a handyman, and a nurse. And the nurse did a medication review. The OT did a full home safety evaluation and training. And then a handyman was available to actually come in and make the changes that were needed in the physical environment. In after 5 months, what they found was improved performance in basic self-care, and then in things like grocery shopping and medication management, and a significant improvement in the symptoms of depression. And so that program really was cost-effective in that. We just had a new study come out at the end of last year that looked at 19 cost factors that medical systems were spending across the country. And it looked at 2,200 hospitals, I think, for memory. And of the 19 cost factors that they looked at, only one of them reduced hospital readmission rates, and that was occupational therapy. So the more money that was spent on occupational therapy, and these were for patients, they went through the Medicare records of all of the patients admitted to that hospital over a year's period of time, and did an analysis on all the factors, spending factors, 19 of them, for heart failure, pneumonia, and acute MI. These are not the clients who typically think of occupational therapy seeing, nor are these the clients that you typically think need home safety evaluations by the occupational therapist or have issues with accessibility. But what they found was that home safety evaluation was a key part of it. The modifications were important, and that having that occupational therapy involvement, they reduced the hospital readmission rates significantly. And so that was really an important piece to look at. The other piece that they said was really important, not only the home safety evaluation, but the functional cognitive evaluation for things like kitchen safety and medication safety. There's another fall come out, another study came out of the New England, out of the England area, looking at over 200 people. It was a randomized controlled trial, and they compared occupational therapy with a trained evaluator. And there's a lot of trained evaluators starting to come up in the community now because this aging in place is really a hot topic. And what they found was that the OT group improved significantly, and not only that, they had significantly less falls. There was something about that unique training that OT brings to match the client to the occupation and their environment that was important. There's a new program being done on the East Coast as well called the HOP program, and they have 300 individuals there that they're also looking at the home safety modification. The results aren't fully in right now, but the initial pilot study is demonstrating decreased costs overall, decreased medical care, and improved quality of life for the participants. This goes on, and if we look at dementia, the reviews are saying the same thing, that looking at a home safety evaluation by OT not only increased their engagement, decreased their risk of falls, but it also increased the self-efficacy and the ability of the caregiver to perform their task safely and also to their quality of life. There's a whole community enablement study that was also done that looked at 30 persons that had medical concerns or recent hospitalization, and this is one area that I think is really important to look at the follow-up. If we're wanting to keep people in the home, when we start to see not only can we impact those who haven't had a medical concern, but we should prioritize those who have. And that evaluation really not only extended their quality of life, but it decreased falls and it decreased the use on health and social services going on. So in conclusion, occupational therapy and the home safety evaluation is really a vital part of aging successfully at home. We can decrease health decline, we can reduce falls, increase participation, increase the quality of life, reduce hospital readmissions, and decrease costs. The key is that we can tailor that evaluation to the unique needs of that client, their values and goals, their caregiver's values and goals, and their environmental context. Thanks.
Thank you. So how does one go about having an occupational therapy review?
So at this stage, you can have an evaluation. So there are two ways. It depends on how you're looking at funding it. So to be covered under the medical insurances right now, you can have an evaluation completed without a doctor's referral, but we need a doctor's referral for further and ongoing intervention. And if there's an acute medical issue, you would need a doctor's referral. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I guess my big question is, who do you call? I mean, you call your insurance company first, I guess, and see if an occupational therapist visit is covered.
It's covered. Yeah, so most of the insurance companies cover at least a minimum visit. For example, if we're looking at insurances for people with lower income like Melina, right now they have an evaluation covered and then 6 hours of therapy is covered without needing pre-authorization. Medicare occupational therapy has a cap of $1,860 for a year. You can request to extend that cap. And so most of the insurance, the occupational therapist would know, the physician could find out.
Do others have any questions? Chuck?
Yes.
Yeah, well, I guess a couple of different things. the first part of your talk was really talking about how to design your home to be more smart and you know, more universal in concept and everything. You know, and so, as a pre-advertisement, AARP has a great guide for doing that. And everything is really, really nice. My main question is, so, and I believe in technology today to assist us in a lot of what you were talking about. That's what you really talked a lot about. And that's great. But along with that comes a lot of cost. And so, I'm just wondering how can, and I don't think Medicare or Medicaid pays for the cost of that.
Of the adaptions.
The new stuff, you know. Yeah. So how does that get covered?
So there's a range of costs. First of all, my key that I always work with clients on is what are the constraints? And the constraints include what are the budget, what are the funding sources, what are the options. If we're talking about advanced and really complicated technology, things like if you have a client who has ALS and wanting to stay at home, then there are certain groups that we support that. ALS is one where there's a lot of options and things available for. For others, it really varies piece by piece. The other thing is, I always start with the simplest options first. First of all, you're looking at new habits and new routines, and those are always disrupted in any way in which they are. The other piece on that, there is potentially some Medicaid funding for the adaptations that we look at, even simple things like a bath bench. Potentially, depending on the time of the year, where you're at, who's your case manager, what's available, is my understanding on that piece. But through Medicare and the other insurances, no, there's not some funding for that. So what do we do? And I think that's a really key piece. We do have some discount suppliers for some of those that are in our area that are making some of those a little more accessible. One of the things about using mainstream technology that I talked about, even some of the things with the Amazon Echo and things that are available from Lowe's and Home Depot now, is that the cost on those, because they're becoming mainstream, is dropping significantly. And so I think you have a progression when you're looking at those. What are the limitations? What's the environmental context? Always start with the simplest first. And there's not a lot of easy answers sometimes. The other thing is that, again, long-term care insurance can be used for some of those adaptations, again, depending on how they're needed, why, and the rationale behind it.
So does that come like from a doctor's prescription to Medicare or Medicaid?
Yes, some of those need a doctor's prescription, but usually the doctor says we need the OT to do the evaluation and have the report that supports that. And some of the demonstration programs that we're looking at and some of the waiver programs we're looking at funding under some grants that way to look at how that works with decreasing the cost. So the Medicare and Medicaid waiver program that we looked at that was on the East Coast, that was funded and found that it was actually cost negative, whichever way you put that down, it actually saved money for the program by actually paying for the OT and the adaptations and the handyman. So that was supportive.
Allie and then Donna.
Yeah, could you elaborate on the older driver safety resources that are available in Clark County, or the program itself?
Yes, so there are a couple of us that are training for cockpit, which means sitting person into their actual car, and I think I'd like to work with ARP to have more of those programs here, since I did that at the university where I taught. We have one full driver evaluation program that's out of Southwest Washington, Peace Health Medical Center, that we did in the outpatient there. But any occupational therapist should be able to actually tell you whether the person needs further evaluation, should be stopped from driving, or is safe. It's that group in the middle that at the highest that we usually use the skilled certified driving rehabilitation specialist for. There's also a place in Portland that will do that. we need more of those in the community as well, because it's a growing area of gas safety.
And would they go, if they, let's say my parents, I'm worried about them, I want them to get a driver evaluation, how do I go about doing it?
Again, doctors call for OT evaluation so for that.
Call your primary care.
Sorry?
Call your primary care provider.
Or call your primary care. And then, you know, when I do those, I do vision, hearing, range of motion. I look at cognition. I do all the screening pieces first. If I'm concerned, then what I'm looking at doing is working with a driving instructor so that then we then do an on-the-road. But usually you have a cutoff. There's definitely people that are not moving on the road. There's people that I don't know that I need to see on the road. And then there's the group that there's no need to evaluate this, that there's definitely not a problem. And I think that's the thing, is it's really easy to be concerned and potentially restrict someone who could have the opportunity to still maintain that mobility.
Great, thank you.
Donna?
I'm interested in the use of therapy dogs. Do you run into that, and do you recommend it?
Again, it really depends on the client. Some people have the ability to work with the dog, because having a therapy dog also demands a level of cognitive ability and memory from the client as well. So I've worked with therapy dogs and had them work with actually training them to put pants, shoes, and socks on for a particular client that I had with MS. It was one of the coolest things, but we actually trained the dog to be the helper to get her side of song.
That's crazy.
I've worked with dogs that are with diabetic dogs. So again, it depends on the person. The funding and the availability for a therapy dog to have one that assists with a self-care task is also difficult, and there's a waiting list for them as well.
So in our housing recommendations, we recommended the Clark County Council some visitability standards. And I think maybe we need to add to those from some of the list we got tonight as we look forward to our end of the year report. We might want to add things about lighting and organizers, electronics.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a great point. You really brought up a good point too, and it's really overlooked a lot, the importance of light.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
That's overlooked almost all the time.
It doesn't happen to me either. And lighting that's task specific, you know, looking at those keys. So we understand that there's certain work areas within a home. What does that look like? Also thinking about automated lighting for mobility in terms of getting up at night, having to go to the bathroom. It's very simple to look at automated night lights now that can solve that problem. Even automated lighting on stairways, if you're looking at that. So I think those are definitely key.
You mentioned something, I think you referred to it as e-cottages.
Yes, those are the fully electronic cottages. There are three models that are available in the US now. And so those actually can do, like I said, you can have very advanced technology related to that. And often they come with a care company monitoring them if someone looks at it. It's also easy, they can tell someone has a urinary tract infection, they can tell they're not having enough fluids in. They can be that complicated.
So is that a physical, I mean, I'm picturing kind of a space capsule thing that gets put in the house. I mean, help me out here. What's that look like?
It is actually a typical cottage. Some of them are half the size of this room. Some of them are bigger. That
go inside an existing home.
And they usually drop into the backyard of a family member's home or something like that. So they're looking at or into smaller villages of those. So there's a couple of different models that are being trialed. I can send you some links.
Yeah, that'd be good. We might add those to our list for housing.
Yeah, and the piece with that is that they allow people who need more advanced monitoring to stay at home even longer, or not have that person in the house necessarily in their space, but still being able to monitor what's happening. They can say if they fell, the floors are very sensitive, they know when they got out of bed. I mean, there's a range of technology options.
Thank you. We would love that information.
Could you give us the general cost of one of these? I'm sure it varies, but...
It does vary, and I, at this stage, I would hate to give that and misspeak. Yeah. I send a link. There are three different companies that are doing that now. Mm-hmm. And there are some home care agencies that are wanting to link with those companies to be able to provide those integrated services. So there's someone actually watching those monitors and then being able to activate services. But you can also have it with a family member or the caregiver. If you have a son or daughter that's taking care of a parent, they can have their independent place in the yard, but they get warnings even when they're at work, or they can check what's happening. And those things may work in certain situations.
So those of you out there, we're ready for your questions. So raise your hand, and when Jackie gets to you, give us your name and your question.
My name is Beth. I have a situation. I'm trying not to make it too specific, but you obviously have to make the patient or the client agree with what you're going to do. And it seems like that might be the most difficult of things, especially if it's a person who's fighting to stay home. And the reason they're doing that is because they want their home to remain the same. So all these changes might be very difficult to suggest. I'm not sure what my question is, but you understand the difficulty.
Yes, I understand the difficulty. I've been in that situation many times. One of the keys is, again, involving the person in the process. And that's why we look at some of those evaluations that occupational therapy has, because it's matching levels, their values, with what you're looking at too. And then thinking about how do you work with that to increase safety or to increase participation. And what does that look like? How do you then develop a relationship of trust and a relationship of understanding that allows you to move forward? And it takes time, it's not always successful, but it is an art and a skill.
How well fixed are we in this county to provide these services, say on a scale of 1 to 10? Where are we?
That's a really good question. So we do have occupational therapists here in home health. We do have occupational therapists at the hospital. We have very few. I'm the only one in private practice here that's looking at home modifications and looking at living at home at this stage. We're continuing to graduate a large number of occupational therapists. The key is to be able to get them into these environments and looking at ways to fund them. And I think that's going to be an important challenge. So I would think we're at a 4 or 5.
We got work to do.
We do.
Do you have paraprofessional aides or assistants who help you cross down?
Yes, we do have occupational therapy assistants. And we have 3 colleges in Washington that graduate occupational therapy assistants, and there is an occupational therapy assistant trained in home modifications and home design in this county as well.
There's a question over here, Jackie.
My name is Chris Thomas, and a lot of the, I'm thankful there's a lot of home automation coming out. There's a lot of new technology, and I think it might be great for our millennial generation who grew up on automation and things, but when we're talking about seniors and the aging population and putting something like an Echo or Dot that orders something that they didn't ask for or pay for, that changed their channel on their music radio, it's dealing with situations like that, as well as you get the technology set up, but then you leave, and then the batteries die, or who follows up with these people? Is this occupational therapy? Is this home caregivers? Is this family members that are having them to continually retrain on the home automation? Because somebody who you can get set up and leave, but then what happens after that? How do you address that?
I usually have a plan. And as I said, I work with the least invasive, the least innovative, lower level stuff first. At give, because change is hard for all of us, and if we've not used technology, it can be very complicated. We're looking at challenges to learning. We're looking at ability to adapt. So all of those things come into the equation. But a plan should actually have a written plan that you leave with your client that says, if this happens, do this. If this happens, do that. Because that's really important part of that, and it should be training people on how to do that. What happens if this gets a blank screen? Or that ominous blue screen that we sometimes see in case or am I the only one?
My name is Yvonne Fallon. I was wondering, do you have a possibility of engaging people before their need?
Yes, and I think that's really key. I think when we looked at the program on that first round of research that I talked about, that was the well elderly study, we demonstrated the concept was well elderly. We demonstrated that having occupational therapists working with those clients, in that case it was in groups, was very cost effective in reducing the overall long-term cost, and it was able to be preemptive in that respect. So we're talking about visibility, we're talking about accessibility in ADA, but we can also pre-plan on that individual level as well with the occupational therapist. The other piece that occupational therapists are doing a lot of now is retirement planning, not from the financial perspective, but what does that look like in terms of what you're doing in your time? That whole wellness and prevention piece, which is so important. I think the thing that I saw a lot working in the assisted livings here were the people who retired and had no plan, and they sat at home and turned on the TV, and then they faced the health crises after that. And that's really, I think, where we need to be going, is that preemptive piece of what does a healthy retirement and healthy occupation and participation look like? How can we maintain that as long as possible? And then as we anticipate changes, what can we add to that?
Hi, I'm Hannah. Is there a website for geared towards caregivers that you can recommend for any of this happening?
There are several websites geared towards caregivers. Again, it really depends. There are some that are very specific, and there are some support groups that are very specific. So again, it would depend on the individual situation, which one I would recommend. I know AARP has a really good caregiver website that's been working on now. You had a thing on caregivers 2 months ago, is that correct, I think? There was some information, if you go back and look at the video on that. There's the HOPE support groups for people who are taking care of persons with dementia. I've spoken at those, and we'll be continuing to do some work with those. Those are really helpful. There are stroke support groups for people who have had strokes. So again, it really is going to depend on your unique needs, because being able to match it again to that is really going to help get you the best support that's available.
Next question up here. Did you have a question?
I live in a house with a large garden and front yard and in Washington. I'm small and I don't have good shoulders anymore. I need the kind of help that comes in maybe once a week, once 2 weeks. Recently, my lawn was about 2 feet high, and I was pushing away, and fortunately my next door neighbor, who's much bigger than I am, came and cut it for me. But that's now. And when I'm asking about getting help on a more regularly standard basis, it always comes out to a question of volunteers. I think this subject is too important to be always handled by volunteers. And I know there's no money for anything. So I'm just wondering, how do we go about getting that kind of help?
I think that's a really good question for each community, because I think definitely that's important. There's several things we know. One, being outside, being involved in areas that are green, and we also have lots of studies looking at taking people who are aging and taking people who have dementia and putting them in garden spaces. Even if they're not actively involved in the garden, but just being in the garden space decreases depression, decreases some of the behavioral issues that you see in people with dementia. And so being able to support those spaces and being able to have people involved is key. And of course, I'm a gardener, and I'll send you a couple of my deer that are eating my strawberry plants right now. Shoot to hell, if only they eat the lawn. But I think that's definitely something as communities we need to look at, because those spaces around our home and the occupations that we perform around our home are just as valuable to us often as the ones that happen inside our home. And they also improve our quality of life. And so I think knowing how to, as a community, support and navigate that is going to be some of the next key issues. And that livability and visitability includes those outdoor spaces as well as the indoor ones. I don't have easy answers. My parents just faced that in Australia, and finally the neighbor was coming over and doing it regularly, and finally the VA finally just sent someone to move the lawn once every 2 weeks for them.
So. Australia is a long way off, though, isn't it?
Yes.
Any other questions?
Just a quick comment. Just on that issue, there are companies all over Southwest Washington that have teams of volunteers that will take requests. Bank of America, like them or not, they have a big volunteer group. Target has one. Winco has one. So it's easy to go to the resource center, the volunteer resource center, and ask them who to contact if you want something done by a group of volunteers. And that they have every bit of information you could possibly want on volunteerism.
Where is that?
It's on 136th.
So you talk about volunteer connection.
Yeah. Well, that's the whole thing. The resource center is all in there.
I can't remember the address.
But it's out on the east side. And I would highly recommend talking to them, because they'll send you in the right direction, I promise.
I think Christine has her hand up.
So I just want to make sure we get them to the right landing space. I think you're talking about the Human Services Council. Is that the organization that you're referring to? So if you do a Google for Human Services Council, you'll be able to find that resource she's talking about.
Yes.
Thank you, Christine. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you for the opportunity.
The next part of our program is member recognition. One of the members who will be going off the Commission on Aging is Herb Maxey, and he's not here this evening, but I just wanted you to know a little bit about him. Prior to retirement, Herb was a senior loss control consultant for 25 years with Farmers Insurance, working with business owners on safety and safe workplace. While at Farmers, Herb served on the Governor's Advisory Board for Industrial Safety and Health, including terms as president and vice president, and working extensively on ADA programs that focused on disabled and senior citizens. Previously to this experience, Herb worked for 3 years as an insurance investment agent for the Prudential Group, a safety administrator for Brie Dre Yagi, and an officer for the California Highway Patrol. Herb joined the Commission on Aging in November 2015, and we've appreciated his consistent attendance and brief, concise comments and questions during our meetings. Shakespeare said, "Men of few words are the best." Thank you, Herb, for being one of the best men in your service on the Commission on Aging, and we will be sending him a certificate of appreciation. The other member who's leaving us is Bill Ritchie, who is here. Bill has long been an actively involved citizen and volunteer in helping others, including serving as the founding and senior pastor of Crossroads Community Church until 2013. During his time with Crossroads Church, he accomplished a great deal, including a daily radio broadcast on more than 300 stations around the country and conducting leadership development in countries that include Indonesia, Malaysia, Nicaragua, Mexico, and Argentina. He has also written 3 publications and launched a 501c3 devoted to boomers and beyond. Whoopi Goldberg, don't worry, Bill, this is a quote from Whoopi. Whoopi Goldberg said, "If every American donated 5 hours a week, it would equal the labor of 20 million full-time volunteers." Bill has done more than his share of volunteering. Thank you, Bill, for serving on the Commission on Aging and serving as chair for 2 years. Chuck Frayer now is going to offer a few words also about you. Hang on.
Let's just move past that.
Well, I don't know if some of you don't know this, but I'm the old man of the old group here now.
You're the only man in the old group.
Yeah, I guess that's right, huh? Thanks, Bill. But when Bill came on, we were a young group. We've only been around for about 5 years now there. And when Bill came on, we were really struggling with leadership and where we really wanted to go and everything. And Bill got elected right off the bat. I mean, it was his very first day, very first time, right, you know, sitting with us. And we said, "Bill, you're the man." And Bill said, "You didn't know what to do." He's like, okay. But shortly after that, and I do mean shortly, like the next day, Bill is calling me. And Chuck, what am I going to do? What's going on? Da, 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 da. Well, after that, for 2+ years, Bill's calling. We go on road trips. We go out and look at stuff. And so through all of that, Bill really threw his self into what we were all about and where we could go as a group, as an organization that could assist aging in place and be a very active part of what the community is today. And through all of that, you know, I really learned a lot by listening to Bill and his ideas, which, by the way, some of them were a little bit out there, but nevertheless, some of them were pretty doggone good, too. And that all of that really led us out of a very, very bad place in time for our group to where we are today. And so I just personally want to thank Bill for all of the calls and his time and his leadership with us. It's been a great 3 years for Bill. And I can't even believe it's been 3 years.
I know.
3 years. So that's just amazing to me. So thank you.
I agree.
Here, here.
Okay.
And say a few words.
Say a few words.
Yeah, Bill doesn't say a few words, by the way. He's kind of old man.
It takes me a few words to get warmed up. It's been a real pleasure for me to be a part of this group. And as Chuck said, I had no idea what I was getting into, being elected a chairperson the first time I came. And I'm trying to figure out what the group was. But realizing that
knowing a bit about aging and everything having to do with aging, so I was transitioning out of what I was doing. I did a considerable amount of reading in the field overall, and understanding that Clark County, like most every other county in the country, is shifting greatly to an aging population. And when you figure it's about 11,000 and change every day, 7 days a week until 2030, somebody's turning 65. It just tells you a lot about what communities have to be prepared for, and they aren't. Ours are among them. And so there's a considerable amount of work that has to be done by a group like this, as well as a whole lot of other groups in the country. And if you look at any community, you find less and less who are younger investing themselves in the civic arena. If you go into service organizations, they're very gray like me. Most any organization that you look at is that way. And so we still have a great deal of responsibility for things that we have to do to make our community fit for the next generation. Everything from, I was so excited to read the paper today, all the stuff that Vancouver is doing for the clean streets, and everything having to do with making streets more usable for the whole population. Because what works well for the older works well for the younger. Just like you don't want a senior to be weaving in and out of a car where there are cars to take a walk where there are no sidewalks, neither do you want somebody with a stroller doing the same thing. So how do we do that? It all takes funds. It all takes, and I so identify with what you said. Because technology is changing so rapidly that just when you finally learn how to use your Echo or whatever, it's obsolete. And they're on to the next thing. And that is not a small challenge. I mean, my grandson, who's a sophomore in high school, builds computers. And I just think, you've got to be kidding me. You know, and many people are still struggling to turn them on. So it has been a blast to be a part of this group. I've loved most every minute of it. And I look forward to the next step of stuff that I get to do. Thank you very much, and best in the future.
We now move to election of officers for next year. We'll entertain a motion for nominations.
I nominate Marjorie Liddell to serve another year as chair.
Okay, are there other nominations for chair? If not, all those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed? Nominations are open for vice chair.
I'd like to nominate Marian Anderson for vice chair.
Are there other nominations for vice chair? All those in favor?
Aye.
All those opposed?
Aye. You would do.
Okay. You're voted.
Announcements. Our speaker next time, we'll have two of them, a pharmacist and a pain management specialist. Our pharmacist is Clara Chambers from the VA, and pain management person is to be identified. Also want to announce that our new members are Amy Gross and Temple Lentz, and they will be joining us in June. Are there any public comments?
My name is Carla Whitson. I'm with the Brain Injury Alliance in Washington, and I just want to let people know that I am a resource manager here in Clark County, and I work with people who have experienced a brain injury. Paperwork on the back, if anyone wants to look at it. It's a free, state-funded program.
Okay. Anyone else? We are adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.